Greetings, everybody, and welcome to another installment of Innovation Crush, recorded right here at WeWorks Podcast Studios in Century City, California. We.co/crush if you want to find out more information about that. And in the meantime, if you guys haven't tuned into the show, we cover all things innovation, ideas, creativity, smart people doing smart things. And I think I have one of the smartest in the room. No, don't say no. You can't. You're not allowed to. You have to humble yourself. Scott Kajiya, say hello, Scott.
Hi there.
You want to get a little closer to that mic, Scott, so I can. You look beautiful. I just wanted to hear how beautiful you are.
Yeah, man. Okay. That's good.
So, I guess for starters, if you don't mind, give me a little bit of the 101. What's the? And I know there's no abbreviated version of your life and career thus far, but. What's the small length version of it?
Probably the most influential, most important is I started a small advertising design office in Tokyo, Japan, and I moved over there as a decision to want to travel. And then I'm, you know, Japanese ancestry, and it was really important to get to a culture where I was part of the majority. It was eye opening it really made me understand my Japanese side of me better, and then also my Americanness, how different I was. I wasn't completely like a Japanese person, Japanese national, so I was in this kind of odd limbo, which became an advantage at that time because I was subject to those normal Japanese mannerisms, and I could be a little bit more, break the rules and so forth, and it helped a lot in especially advertising design.
Yeah. Did you realize the power in that, like, at the time, or did you kind of, like, you sound like you went when you were young and to travel, like you had this whole secondary initiative in your head?
Not in the beginning. I thought, wow, this is really difficult and it's not working well. Then it started to change. At some point it became it hit critical mass where it became a positive, a big positive. And I think there was an evolution in the Japanese culture as well, where it was going through a big boom period, right? That was what, between the mid 80s, early 90s, it was booming until it hit that Lehman shock, but it was booming and everything was possible. And there was money was being spent on everything. And that was when they were buying all the buildings in downtown LA, golf courses all over the US. And then, so everybody had all this excess capital to try new ideas and they were open. And that's kind of how it was, and it became.
Yeah, and then, like, from what I understand, like, I mean, you had an amazing journey over there, opening clubs, launching fashion collections, Indian motorcycle. What would you say is, I guess, your crown jewel accomplishment there?
Yeah. I think the most we didn't even have an idea what would happen, but we started this club called Tools Bar. It was in Nishiozabu, and it became this iconic destination for anybody who came into town. And it was a dive bar because in that time, we became like the first DJ bar. Every night we changed the DJ, and we had a line every night outside for a few years outside to get in because it was a small place. And we made it very accessible. The cover charge was very minimal. It came with two drink tickets. We had the system where you got in, you paid the low entry fee at the door, and then you got two drink tickets. And we always had a cool DJ, and a lot of those people came, big music producers and famous DJs. And
give us some names.
One, you probably know who Fujiwara Hiroshi is.
Oh yeah,
yeah, he was DJing there, and
oh my gosh,
yeah, a lot of a lot of different people like that, and some people from here. We have a paint on the door. Jean-Michel Basquiat painted some illustrations on one of the doors inside.
Yeah.
And Keith Haring did his crawling babies across a certain part. So those kind of people would come through. And, we were able to connect. We connected all globally where there's a club network. So I used to meet all the other owners from New York. And, we would travel around to go see all the other clubs in Paris and Thailand and London, and big club scene was New York at that time. So we would, it was fun because we were kind of, everyone knew us and we knew them. And
So I'm going to get into what you're up to today pretty soon. But what would you say you identified as your superpower? Because you've done a lot, right? And we'll get into it. But what's that one thing that Scott brings to any situation, any business, any, you know, creative environment that nobody else has?
I don't think there's something that nobody else has. I think there it's inherent in certain people, but I think I approach everything through kind of a design sensibility. Like the design is really important to me because I was advertising design and so forth. So the visual, it's probably the visual, which I kind of flipped into being that artistic edge, whatever it's, I've always seemed to get along with the designers and the creators and artists. It's easier for me to converse with the artists. And I used to do some things very similar to what you're doing here, where I would all the kind of
embarrass yourself.
Well,
no,
as much as possible. You know, you got to be a fool first. And I think that's kind of how the approach is. I'm kind of really particular, visually particular, I would probably say. And that's kind of driven, always been something inside of me.
Yeah.
And so I approach it kind of everything kind of visually. That's probably where it starts.
That's great. So when I taking that as sort of a nucleus of how you approach things, tell us a little bit about Taboo, because it is massive and it's just starting and it's only going to get more massive.
Right. It's actually Taboo gave birth to two other companies that I'd like to talk about as well, because they're all related. But Taboo's Vancouver based. And what we're going to do with Taboo right now, it's going to list on the Canadian Stock Exchange probably in a couple months. And we decided, because of all the big boys up there, we decided to be a dispensary specific. And also we'll have our own private label CBD line,
right?
Taboo CBD, which is more for global distribution. And we're also, so it's going to be, we'll have CBD, we'll have our dispensaries, and we're also going to take an investment in a extraction lab here in California.
That's pretty great.
Yeah, so we'll do that.
So, you know, when you and I first met, maybe a couple of years ago now, or a little over a year, this was kind of seemed like it was just paperwork, right? It was like it was a thought, and it was just like, oh. Yeah. And so when you look at the cannabis industry and Canada, which newly became the legalization was there, you were kind of ahead of the curve in just identifying this as a business opportunity. So what were some of the things that you saw? Like, what were the writings on the wall, if you will? Not the Keith Harris or the...
There was a couple of things that happened that were parallel. These friends of mine were one of the largest nutritional supplement companies in the world. Rexall Sundown, Jim Iragi, and Carl DeSantis. And we were discussing one day CBD products, something to look into. And then when we were trying to do an energy related company up in Vancouver, and we were started to put this small pipeline and a small oil producing facility into contract, and we were going to investment bankers and pitching the idea. And they came back with us, this is a few years back, they said, we're not looking at energy sector, we're not looking at mining or tech right now. And I said, well, what are you looking at? And they said, we're just looking at cannabis investments. And so we said, and then right at that week, somebody calls us and said, hey, we have a cannabis project, do you guys want to join up with us and discuss it? And that just flipped the model. And
right,
we were talking to one of the most influential investment banking firms, and they had changed. They were looking into the cannabis sector and already started investment. And that's when Canopy and Aurora, those mega companies, were very small still.
Yeah.
And have taken off now to be, you know, $25 billion market caps and so forth. So that's how it started, and then segued into meeting other Canadians who were interested in investing. And that gave, if I may divide this up, there's basically three main verticals I'm operating in now. And one is a company called Next Green Wave.
Mm-hmm.
And that's already listed, and it's really going well. Lee Hughes, Paul Chow are the founders, and this guy Mike Jennings is kind of the cannabis doctor, six straight Cannabis Cup winner, rock star. And that project is...
What does it take to win a Cannabis Cup?
That's really a good question. Because I never won a Cannabis Cup.
Like a shovel and some water. Yeah. No, I'm kidding. I don't know.
No, you have to have the proper genetics and it's tested and you have all this competition. And I never figured it out because the judges are all smoking weed. And they're like, I said, I would ask a judge, hey, how can you tell the difference after, three or four puffs on this one? You got to try that one.
Right.
So to me, it's kind of, I'm unsure exactly.
Yeah, there's some questionable criteria. But obviously there's some methodology of picking a winner.
There has to be something. And
right.
To win that many times,
right.
You have to really, it has a lot to do with the genetics.
Yes.
And so what's interesting about, so there's Taboo, NGW, it's Next Green Wave. And what's interesting about Next Green Wave is we're trying to be super premium. We are going to be super premium. Cannabis is smaller.
Mm-hmm.
There's a 35,000 square foot ground up, beautiful facility. That's the construction's finished. We'll probably go to first crop will be out about June of this year. And I think what's really innovative is that we've licensed some genetic new technology, which allows us to not use seeds. And it's basically, it's just like, it's cloning.
Okay.
And so, this company is the innovative multi-billion-dollar company, and we've been allowed to license it for cannabis. So we're really fortunate.
That's super cool. Have you been able to see that process? And or, I think when you hesitated a little bit on the word cloning.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
It's kind of sensitive.
Yeah, it's a sensitive topic.
GMO and everybody gets to this negative stuff.
Yeah.
But the world, the world really, I think the world really needs it because it's going to help the food pool and it's improving the quality of those fruits and vegetables. They're across the board and as far as working in human benefits, plant and animal benefits, they do everything.
Right.
And so I think that's what's important, and it's taking the good innovation there and applying it to different, like to cannabis. And it streamlines the process and it allows us to use less. We don't need soil.
Right.
You can save space. It saves time and, saves, you get a better organism.
Well, and I think part of this entire industry, it's a perception problem, right? Or a battle of perceptions, yeah, right? Yes, you got weed smoking hippies and you got like, this is a viable business, especially when you think about the medical implications.
Exactly.
and the sustainability efforts that you're mentioning is like smaller footprint, less water, all these other things. And I think when most people hear about the cannabis industry, they don't think about that, right? They think about the dispensary that may have opened up in the neighborhood or the crime that may have happened or not have happened, just the perception issue.
Yes.
Is there anything in your pipeline that will combat, perception and help educate people on the entire process? Because you guys are going from like farm to
customer. Table.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, farm to table.
Farm to table. But no, if you look at the companies in Trexon, and they, if you look at their board and, PhDs and Harvard lawyers and all that kind of stuff. And they're licensing to the cannabis industry,
right,
their technology. And so it's changed dramatically.
Mm.
And it's especially the third vertical I'm involved in is a company called Blessin LLC. That's basically purely a CBD oriented company.
Mm-hmm.
It's out of Texas and we're probably the largest, CBD extraction, or top three probably in the United States, our footprint as far as isolate and distillate and providing. And then we have a private label wing. But I think that is a different vertical. But you see it's important, I think, that myth where people are taking the hemp plant and people thought THC, CBD, marijuana is all the same thing.
Mm.
But there's completely different products here.
Right.
And so you see the other Fortune 500 companies, pharmaceutical companies, beverage companies, all the major companies coming in the industry now. It's a big crossover.
When does the lobbying start? I'm kidding.
Endless.
I was thinking about, like, you know, at least in the United States, right? Like, because in Canada, it was across the entire country, the legalization. But then in the U.S., it's so individually regulated. Was it 13 states, I believe, right now?
Yeah, I think it's going to be a third, a third, and a third, where, you know, there'll be a third's everything, a third's probably medical only, and a third's probably nothing.
Right. And is that something that you guys plan on participating in, right? And as far as, like, governmental relations and helping to, I guess, selfishly in a way, broaden your scope of possibility, but also just, again, that education, that whole throughput, and the power that you guys will have as with size, could mean a lot of other changes.
Absolutely. We, you know, I'll try to attend as many of those politically related meetings as possible. I did attend one for the state of California for the Cannabis Bank with the Secretary Treasurer of California and a lot of the politicians. It's a different world for me, but it's very interesting.
Yeah.
And it helps. It really does, to find out what's going on and what they don't know and what they do know. So there's a lot going on here.
Well, finally, you mentioned just kind of like going into uncharted territory, which you've done a lot of throughout your career, right? You just moved to Japan, like, and then you start advertising there, and then you start a club. Like, there's this sort of like venture and curiosity into the unknown. One thing I wanted to ask, as far as taboo goes, what was one of the bigger learning curves you had? Maybe there was a surprise that kind of like, oh, I didn't know I was going to run into that as a problem or an opportunity or something that jumped out at you. It was like, oh, I didn't expect this.
You know, I don't think there weren't any kind of difficulties being in Canada. There was a lot of opportunity. And I think that, I think the difficulty was, In all the markets, whether it's California, Canada, we deal in Colorado, Texas, Oregon, there is that initial, I guess, everybody finding out what can be done and what can't be done, what's legal and what's illegal, because each area is different. You know, like,
yeah.
Canada doesn't have any, the edibles are still not coming to market, you know, and there's not enough dispensaries yet, but you have this reputation, have these big, financially wealthy entities there that are kind of dominant in the marketplace, but the infrastructure is still not built out.
Yeah.
So it's different. But I don't think I think that's the education and also doing your due diligence on what really is legal or illegal.
Yeah.
And it's also very,
what's going to happen to drug dealers? I asked that jokingly, but part of me thinks, like, you know, some bad hombres. I was going to say that that's not right. But some bad people have made a lot of money and a living, and, you know, they're territorial. But I think there also has to be some ingenuity on that side of the coin, or there will be. I won't say there has to be, but there will be some sort of, either they're going to change their product pipeline, or they'll, you know, go to Texas or go to California and then go home to wherever they are. I don't know if you've touched on that in any way, but just kind of like the balance of what's illegal and what's legal.
You know, that's a really interesting point, because we talk about it a lot, in that the gray market, it's called the gray market or the black market, still exists. And people were very much afraid, in talking to those kind of people, they were opposed to legalization. And because, of course, they thought it was going to affect their market. And what's happened is it doesn't seem to have affected the market, because there's so many. So what's happened is the price has gotten more expensive with all the taxes.
Mm.
So then you have the gray market, we could sell under that price point, and that's one. And then I think the export out of those legal states is the big market, the prices that they can get for the gray market outside the legal states.
Yeah.
And that still thrives.
That's pretty crazy. Good luck on that part. And then as far as other territories open up, like you mentioned when we chatted on the phone about exporting to Europe and just other, not just US and Canada, but like around the world, how are you keeping tabs on where those opportunities are going to be, you know, because it is such a mass market opportunity, but you also have to be very strategic and calculated and, you know, and smart about your moves.
Exactly. That's why we've gone into typically taboos doing CBD. It's much easier to deal in the CBD. And it's our belief that the CBD market will far exceed what the THC market is. And Blessin, basically is strict only CBD.
Yeah.
And I think that's what we've identified. And we have some projects outside the United States now. We created this brand, Canna Primo, and that's for the Mexican market.
Mm.
But after meeting with them, we decided to make it a global market. So that will be taken globally.
You seem pretty relaxed for all this work that's in front of you. How do you maintain this zen through it all? Because most of you are like, and then we got to, you know, like, it seems daunting, right? Like, especially in your startup, like it's a young company, but you know, even if you visit taboo.com, which I suggest you guys do, but it goes from
taboo.ca.
My apologies, taboo.ca. But you know, you've got artists, there's an artist program, there's, you know, market analysis and risk assessments and all these things. But, you know, you're here in all black and just chilling. So, like, what? how do you balance, like, the massive nature of what has to be done and your own sort of sanity?
I think what you find is, and you guys probably hear as well, it's the team you create. So one of the most important things I find is that 1 + 1 has to equal 3, that my whole team, or the people I work with, is I enjoy talking with them, and I can get, when I wake up, if I want to call somebody, it's like, if you wake up and you don't want to call that person, man, that they shouldn't be on your team.
Right.
But if you wake up and you say, wow, I look forward to talking to them, and you could find renewal and more energy. That's where that 1 + 1 = 3 happens. It's like you get more energy from being together with them.
Right.
As opposed to not. And look for that in creating those partnerships and all those companies. And then it becomes very powerful. And I could, it's non-stressful.
Yeah.
It's basically stress relieving to go ahead and want to see those people or meet with them and brainstorm.
We talk about that a lot too, with building innovation teams, and that, like, we forget that there's a human connection to the whole process of building a business. You know, we can look at the resumes and the numbers and go like, oh, that guy has done this, so let's have him do this here. But you're talking about this really like an emotional attraction in a sense, you know, to the people that you're encountering on a day-to-day basis. So what kind of traits do you look at? Like what kind of traits resonate best with a Scott Coggia, you know, in that regard?
It's a basic, important human traits that we all need, that I think that in caring individuals, for one, caring about each other, really simple things. Also dynamic, but caring, humble, but dynamic still. I look for those kind of things, that similar concerns sometimes about the environment, where we're going. All those things matter. It's those basic human things, goodness, you know, respect. And it's good, irreverence at the same time.
Yeah.
You need that kind of cutting edge, that edginess at the same time. So it all blends together. And I think I always look for just kindness and goodness. And then, of course, intelligence and drive.
I guess I'll put my resume back in my bag. No, I'm just kidding. No, that's great. And so, you know, because I think a lot of us, we make those decisions based on what the goals are, not based on what the connection is. I'm glad you brought that up. And I think when you talk about irreverence, which is also this idea, you said it earlier, not being afraid to be a fool first. Tell us how that shows up for you on a day-to-day basis. Because I think when you are first and you're a trailblazer and, you know, this is one of the largest companies that I know of that's kind of playing in this space. There are going to be mistakes. I won't call them failures because I think we over glorify the sense of failure, but this idea of mistakes and just kind of like, let's try something and see what happens. But tell us about your brand of this fool first strategy.
You know, I think what's happened sometimes is when you have so much going on and you cannot watch over everything. And my feeling has always been, it's not in the product or what you're doing that becomes a distraction, that becomes somewhat of a failure. It's more in that there were mistakes made in the team. And it's like any successful, look at a sports team, like look at the Rams, how they were when they changed the coach and now they're winning all the games, or the Lakers before LeBron James got here.
Yeah.
You know? So it's that team, I think, that I always look back and I think was the wrong person, or it's not the project ever, because you could fix that project. And it's always been, I think my regrets have been that the team's been a little bit off because of certain players, and it's really hard to extract someone once they're on the team as opposed to adding someone. It's really easy.
Oh, yeah. And it gets harder the bigger your company gets, because then you've got protocol and you've got all these things. And so you have to go through this feedback loop, and there's things that you need to follow in order to get that team right. And there was a guest previously who once said any problem at any company is a people problem. And, you know, so how do you, if somebody is performing less than, and I know you're at the apex of this, so you're probably like a very equal team in terms of hierarchy, I guess. How do you go about giving feedback, constructive criticism? You know, hey, Joe, I didn't like what you said yesterday. Is it like a lot of Three Stooges slaps, or is it more like, what's that communication style?
No, it's like, you should change your clothes. You shouldn't be wearing that. Just like, I don't like that shirt. No, I'm not like that. I'm just something.
Right.
It's like, that fucked
did you me. Shave?
Yeah. No, it's typically. I don't get involved in too many, HR kind of thing. I just stay away for as much as possible, because that's just not my thing.
Right.
I can't say you're out of here. I just cannot do that.
Well, not so much like you're out of here, but like, I didn't like the way you handled that meeting, you know, or I don't want our company to be reflected that way. Or, you know, maybe something in your personal life is showing up.
That up, because yeah, we just had that talk today. This morning I had an issue with somebody, and one of my partners, I told him, look, this is not told any kind of, it can't be represented like this. And it had to do with somebody in the company and just the way they carry themselves. I don't want to touch that, because so I let somebody else do it.
Right.
That's just not me.
So they were judging the cannabis cup? Is that what you're saying? No. one of the things that kind of jumped out at me, you have a degree in social ecology, which I have no idea what it is, but an additional study in theology. So what was your game plan going into school? Did you have a plan? Like, what did you plan on becoming?
It was not like you're going to become something. I never thought this is what I want to be. It's not that. I was going to, after college, I was going to I applied to go to this theology school in Switzerland. And I got a response back and I could attend there. But I thought I had to study French before I left. So I went into it. Summer course, and then while I was at that summer school, was in Northern California, and my dad at that time was living in Northern California, Monterey Peninsula. So I was up there, and then I was going to San Francisco a lot, and I met some other people there, and I just made a career flip And I said, well, I don't know if I really want to go to theology school in Switzerland right now. And I was going to a different theology school for a while. And then my path changed and I got off into business. And I became an entrepreneur at that point, right after college. It was a good decision, I think. But I have to feel it was a good decision.
So far, so good.
Yeah.
What was that first business?
I manufactured ice cream.
Hmm.
Yeah. So I was really critical because I love ice cream.
Like every time I talk to you, first of all, there's like a new layer, a new flavor. There's a new flavor of Scott every time. No. Yeah. All right. So you started ice cream manufacturing.
I started an ice cream. There was a guy in San Francisco he was a great guy, character. In Noe Valley, Bud's Ice Cream. And so I started a franchise of Bud's Ice Cream here in Southern Cal. I did that for a few years. And it was before the ice cream boom, it was a yogurt boom going on. And I was an ice cream pioneer.
Yeah, you kept it OG.
Of course.
Get this TCBY stuff. No, that's great. So, we were talking a little bit about this yesterday, the sense of curiosity that kind of carries you from place to place. You know, in my case, it's almost to a fault, right? Like, oh, that looks shiny over there. Let's go see what that is and play in it for probably too long. Because there's no linear path to the things that, you know, you've been involved in other than this a designer's mentality. But what keeps you curious and interested, and what has kept you curious? Like, how did you gravitate from one thing to the next and know that it was the right move for you?
I don't think you know if it's right. All these verticals in the cannabis industry, which it's CBD, Taboo, Next Greenway, Blessin', you know, all these verticals that we have. It was basically an evolution. And was I thinking it's the right move at that point in time? You never know until you're in it, until you're going and you're feeling the positive response, you know, because ultimately I'm never satisfied with something, no matter what it is. So I was always thinking there's something else to it and there's a deeper meaning or something. And so I think that dissatisfaction or eternal angst, something that I have that I feel all the time, that kind of motivates me. And I'm not sure what my happiness or what is actually where I'm driven or being driven towards. But I'm kind of figuring it out now. It takes a long time to figure out what you think should happen in your life. And I'm really thinking about, I mean, I'm an outdoor person. I mean, I love the mountains and skiing and fishing and hiking, backpacking or wherever. And I feel most comfortable some outdoor situation, whether it's by the ocean, mountains, somewhere. And I think I feel myself gravitating to more of those spots where it's the city's accessible and the business model is there. But I'm really feeling myself now. I think in the next year or two, I'll set something up in a remote area. It's more think tankable,
right?
Something like that, where I could be the base, where I could just chill. I could still conduct business, but I could just chill and not be in a WeWork space.
I think you touched on something that I've been thinking about lately, is kind of just honoring all these different sides of yourself, right? The angst being part of it. And sometimes, like, I you know, personally, I've been in a position where I'm like, I don't want to feel the angst, but it's kind of what moves me.
It's driving you.
Right? So it's a weird duality, because it's uncomfortable, but I think you have to be comfortable with the idea of being uncomfortable. And
absolutely.
So it's a little meta, but it's also hard to manage sometimes, right?
Sometimes it is, because you're feeling, why is that I'm so unsatisfied all the time? Why is it I want to change something all the time? And then it's that internal conflict. And you have to find that balance where I could be comfortable and find moments of peace, whatever. I find that being outside of the normal environment of the city, getting outside the city.
Yeah.
As much as possible, that's what I do. I'll get outside and then or be outside. And that's where I find, so I'm kind of driven for that and to stay physically fit.
Yeah.
So I could participate in outdoor activities.
You want to do a push-up contest?
Sure.
How many you got on you? How many can you knock out?
Oh man, I'm not a big,
you don't want to brag.
I could do,
I was part of a group last year.
What is it?
We had to do 300 a day.
I can't do 300.
Well, no, in a day. So I would break them up into six sets of 50. Yeah. Actually, it was first of like 12 sets of 25.
I could do 50 at a time. So yeah, I could probably do, yeah. I mean, if I have to push it, maybe 75 at once.
You can keep up. Nobody's going to actually check. You can just, you could have said 200.
I'm keeping fit.
You're like Rocky, just one hand in them. I guess, if you had another crown jewel in your career, I keep thinking about the Indian motorcycle, but like, is there something you go like, this is, you know, outside of Taboo, the thing that was most satisfying despite the angst and feeling like it's not done?
Mm. You know, right now I feel like all the things that are happening have the three major projects and that I'm involved in right now. And there's a couple others that we haven't spoken about that I really like, the battery project. But I feel really comfortable for some reason, because all the entities have an energy of their own.
Mm.
And they're going and they're successful and they're really taking off, like really taking off. And it's not because of me. And I think the things that really are a paradigm shift or can help you make a difference in society and culture, they tend to, you're just a catalyst and an assistant to it.
Yeah.
And I'm just,
but it is kind of, but I would argue against that. I would say it is partially due to you. I mean, you're a piece of a puzzle, but an important piece of a puzzle. You know, yes, that without you being there, would that hole be filled eventually? Sure.
And that's that conflict, though, where I want to step back and say, you know, I'm nothing, the nothingness.
Right, right.
I'll reduce myself to nothing and maybe I'll be happier.
Yeah.
So it's not because of me, but sometimes it is because of me.
Yeah.
So I it's that whole conflict. Yeah, step back. It's not because of you. Just shut up. You know, get out the way. And right now, if you have a good alliance and everybody understands that, and it's funny, we don't have any big ego trippers, you know, like even on the board at Taboo, outstanding people.
Right.
But just transcendent.
Yeah.
You know, these guys are rock stars in their own fields. And like Matthew Howson, he had the biggest merger and acquisition. He did the biggest merger and acquisition in the history of Australia.
Mm.
And, you know, Chris Campbell in the cannabis industry is a super well-respected, you know, leader. And so those kind of people, and everybody's really like, they didn't do it. They didn't do anything. And
it's almost like you take, because I wrote this down, you know, I wrote down the phrase, design tells a story, right? And I think most storytellers never quite feel complete. You ask any filmmaker, I just wrote a book and I'm just like, oh, I should have said this, or I wanted to say that. Or you ask anybody who's in a creative, like a true creative craft, they go, they never feel like it's done, right? Yeah. And then there's the balance becomes done is better than perfect. And so like, all right, well, it's got to ship, or you're just up against a deadline. Do you in any way consider yourself a storyteller?
No, I never approach it as storytelling in any way. Not a storyteller at all.
Okay. No. I disagree, but so as we wind down, right, the show is called Innovation Crush. You've seen a lot. You mentioned the battery project. I do want you to talk about that before I get into this last bit. So tell me about the battery stuff.
Well, it's quite far along now. It was resurrected out of a U.S. military Chrysler Mercedes project many, many years ago. Dr. Frank McCullough is the principal of it. And we have a NASA work order to provide a prototype batteries for the Mars rover. And then we did a presentation for Boeing. And we were supposed to supply prototypes for Boeing. And it's far, far more efficient. It's a green battery, carbon-based, no lithium ion. Its energy capacity is much higher. It's lighter. There's no heat buildup. So it sounds perfect.
Yeah.
I think we're close, very, very close, because we're going to present. I think this summer, the prototypes will be ready to go for NASA testing. And Frank's in Houston, right by NASA. So they drop by all the time.
Yeah.
And very good relation there, relationships there. And they like him and they believe him. And we had a conference call with Boeing with seven PhDs, battery division. They grilled Frank like crazy. And they said, man, that guy is smart. And so I kind of...
Wait, he got grilled by NASA and came out with like...
No, oh. The Boeing
guy. Oh, sorry, seven, Boeing. Yeah, yeah.
Boeing battery division. And they were grilled, him.
Still,
and,
yeah.
And they go, whoa. They called back the next day and say, that guy's very smart. And so I think it's got a good shot to make an impact. And it's not to the project is not to make batteries, but to supply the inside of the batteries. Mm. It's all carbon-based. And I think it's going to work. But we'll find out this summer and after Frank gets the prototypes done.
Do you enjoy the education you get on all these industries as you enter them?
Oh, it's fascinating.
Yeah.
Yes, I do. No matter what it is, some little from this side to I embrace it, and whatever it is, I love it.
Yeah, yeah,
I do.
Well, speaking of which, what I was going to say, the show is called Innovation Crush, and I'm curious as to what's out there that you currently have an innovation crush on. It can be IKEA just announced that they have a robot kitchen that they're testing, or it could be a cuisine. It could be something you saw on the way here to the studio at WeWork.co/crush. What do you see out there that you currently have an innovation crush on?
Well, man, that's a... I haven't thought about what my crush is on that, but I just think right now, which I always come back to when you're talking about innovation, and I think there's so many, there's not one big thing. I mean, I think this battery that Frank has is fantastic.
Sounds phenomenal, yeah.
I think this is really important, and there's a lot of interest. I've set up some meetings for him to meet with some very important people to come in to help maybe on the finance side, or a lot of things are happening right now. So that is I think can make a difference for the environment, especially in the storage side. Mm. So we have wind and solar, and storage is a problem because we could use a lot more energy. We could store a lot more if we could store it, and it's not properly stored.
Right.
So they have to go off the grid for a while, or they can't, the wind turbines can't turn, you know, because it's a capacity issue. That's one thing, but I think I always think about that. And you were asking me the other day about innovation and what I think. And I think it's almost interpersonal for me to just keep innovating myself. That if I keep myself tuned, you know, my radar, my personal radar gets developed more, or my spiritual radar keeps continuing to evolve, that I can make better decisions. And instead of turning left, I'll turn right, because that's a better decision.
Right.
That puts you in that proper orbit. And in that proper orbit, you're going to run into people that you need to meet and Absolutely. To succeed. And then it's all about being in that orbit and getting to that level. And I think much more happens. That's why I think I've been in the last few years, I've really been in the orbit I should be in. And things have happened so much easier. Like it's almost effortless to have these projects come to fruition. I think it's probably me. I've been somehow started to fine tune and figure it out, and I'm just going right now, and stuff just happens.
Yeah,
I feel blessed.
I 100% believe that there's a magic that happens, like in tandem with real innovation, right? Because there are 10,000 ideas that pop up on any given day from any given person, I'll say, or a group of people. But to see that idea or those thoughts become a real thing and a viable, long-standing thing, like that's beyond a lot of our control, Right. And it is that human connection. Great things happen when the right people come together, or if you're just, you know, like you said, tuned in, your radar is tuned correctly.
Yeah.
You know, in order to achieve a significant level of success. But thank you for coming. You cheated a little bit, because I always ask people, I go, innovation to me is, and I haven't complete the sentence, but you already said it, what it was for you.
I guess. I don't know. Whatever, man.
Now you're in the downbeat of, I guess, I don't know, whatever. Oh,
yeah, you know.
You know what I mean? Yeah. Basically, you know what I'm saying? You know, we got these batteries, you know what I'm saying? Go to Canada. Man.
You know.
Where can people find out more about, I don't know, you got so many things going on. What's let's go Taboo and Next Green Wave. Like, where, any destinations you wanted to point people to?
Oh, no. I mean, taboo.ca is always, you can come in and see what we're doing. Next Green Wave is totally innovating right now with its own genetics. I think that's going to really take off, you know, with its licensing and the team there, top level team. And then you can't, but the funny thing is, the Blessing Group is somewhere, it's like a horse race. And all of a sudden, I didn't know, but in probably a matter of the last 3 months, I can't even tell you what the size of the scale of what CBD is right now.
Yeah,
it's just beyond belief.
Well, that's the other thing I wanted to touch on, and just as a food for thought, I'll leave with the audience. But the amounts of time that you've mentioned just throughout this interview, it's like 3 months, 6 months, like nothing's like 3, 5, 10 years. It's like these short spans, like these short bursts. And, you know, and I think part of it is you can only really see that far down the road, realistically.
Oh, yeah, don't you think? It's the compression of time.
Right.
Everything happens so much faster.
Mm.
We're in a period, I think, where, you know, we always say business at the speed of thought.
Right.
And you don't have time to... Or not that you don't have the time, but I think the scale and what happens now is so much faster.
Yeah.
People are more adept.
Yeah. Well, thank you, everyone. This has been another installment of Innovation Crush. I am Chris Denson at Densonology on all your social handles, and we will talk to you next time.